Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast with Benji Nyson. We're sitting here with our feet up on the first rest day after the first week of the Tour de France 2020, but we're not resting on our laurels. This episode, we're going to bring you our first interview with a World Tour rider, Lennard Kamna. Some of you may know him already, Germany. We know, we can see in the analytics, you're big fans of the pod, but not just the Germans should know Lennard Kamna. He won a massive stage in the Critérium du Dauphiné just before the Tour de France, the Bora Hansgrohe climber, a future GC contender possibly. But we'll get to that later. First, Benji and I are going to recap just who the stage winners were in the first nine stages and the current position on general classification. Just do a quick recap of what's happened. But yeah, how are you, Benji? Are you enjoying not having to watch the Tour today? Are you enjoying the rest, or are you kind of missing the racing already?
I'm also kind of missing the racing. I'm doing well though on the rest day, but I'm basically just at work because I still have a full-time job. And while I do enjoy my job, I do enjoy watching cycling too. So yeah, I am missing the TDF a bit, but we've got Tirreno as well today. So that's pretty cool too.
Oh yeah, that reminds me. Thanks, Benji. We've got the Tirreno Adriatico Stage 1. That will be a recap of that stage at the end of this podcast after the Lennard Kamna interview. I got to be honest with you guys, and you know I don't like lying to you ever. We just didn't have time to do a Tirreno Adriatico preview show, so it's going to have to be just a recap of stage one. I know you'll forgive us because the Tour de France has been on every day, but it's going to be a sprint stage anyway, so there's your preview already. And Froome and Thomas are riding. You might have heard of them. But getting into the stages of this year's Tour, stage one, it was that rainy, weird day. In hindsight, Benji, is that like, how does that stage fit in your memory? Do you think of it as a weird stage and the winners and sort of top three guys weren't really the strongest riders?
I would say so, but I also would say that it reminds me a bit of the World Championships last year, a very harsh race, and the three riders that came out to be the first three were not necessarily the riders you would put in the top three in a sprint stage. And that's the same that you had at the World Championships last year. Mats Pedersen, Stefan Kung and Trentin were not really the guys I had moved up my list of favorites for the World Championships last year, but they were the strongest in that weather conditions. And these three riders were the strongest sprinters at the end of this pretty horrific day with all the crashes and the horrible rain on the Col de Rimier, I think it was called.
Yes, sorry. Stage one was won by Christoph, Norwegian, then a Dane second, Mads Pedersen, and Case Bol third. That was the first indication that maybe my Case Bol prediction wasn't too great. But those riders, apart from Case Bol, haven't really done too much in the rest of this year's, or the rest of Tour de France first week. Stage two was an absolute barnstormer, starting in Nice and finishing in Nice once again. That was the Julian Alaphilippe stage where he lit it up Milano Sanremo Poggio style on the last climb and gapped everybody pretty much. Although the GC guys weren't really that interested in chasing. And the first stage podium for Mark Hirschi and Adam Yates coming third. And that kind of set up the later Adam Yates yellow jersey. That stage, Benji, I thought that was a great stage, but it was immediately eclipsed by the others. Do you think that was a success, Benji, having like a medium mountain stage in the second stage of the Tour, like that close? It's almost never been done before.
It was a success for me. I don't believe that I expected it to be explosive from the start, which it honestly wasn't, but the last 15 kilometers were intense and very nice to see. We had Alaphilippe just taking it just a second in front of Hirschi, but I also took away two other things. We had lost Sivakov already the day before pretty much for GC. And the second day we lost the Dauphiné winner, Daniel Felipe Martinez. So two riders that were expected to be in the top 10 of the GC of this Tour de France were basically already gone after 2 days.
Yeah, and I forgot to mention in that stage one, all the crashes and how they maybe affected the first week of this year's Tour. Did it affect Bora Hansgrohe a fair bit? I don't really think so. Maybe Mühlberger and Kamna might not have been on top form, but neither was Buchmann anyway coming in. So Alaphilippe goes into yellow, second stage. Everyone might be thinking, oh, wow, is he going to do it again? But I don't think for a second, Benji, Alaphilippe thought he really had a chance of carrying yellow through to Paris. Whereas last year, there would have been moments where he thought, actually, I can really do this. But stage three was a pure sprint stage again, starting in Nice, finishing in Sisteron. There are a few climbs and rolly hills in the middle of the stage, but we knew it was going to come down to a sprint. It was an uphill, sort of false flat drag in the finale. Caleb Ewan won that stage, cementing for me that Caleb Ewan is the fastest man in the world, or the best sprinter in the world. We'll get to our rankings of best sprinter, climber, and all-round rider, etc. in this year's tour later. Alaphilippe obviously holds on to yellow. Was that the first stage, Benji, where you thought Sagan is really not looking close to the other riders, when, or the other sprinters, when, say, Hofstetter was beating him, and even, you know, Nizzolo was putting a fair margin into him as well?
I do believe that we already saw weakness that day. And additionally to that, I also felt like he launched too early. He launched early and pretty much played defensively in the sprint, in the sense that he launched early in the hopes that he could still end pretty high up. And it wasn't necessarily the Sagan move that we saw in the past, where he follows wheels and then comes out at the right moment, which Ewan did on this stage, basically. So, yeah, that was a sign of weakness for me.
That was the Ewan stage where he zigzagged and pinballed his way to the finish, and Bennett kind of came off his line a bit. Stage four, the Ossia Merlet stage, another sort of mountaintop. Jesus, struggling today. Stage four was the Ossia Merlet stage, the first mountaintop finish of the Tour de France this year, but not a genuine mountaintop finish. I'd say a hilltop finish is more accurate. Alaphilippe losing the... Oh no, he's held it. Alaphilippe managing to retain the yellow jersey, but Primoz Roglic winning the stage. It was just another case of uphill, you know, sort of climbing drag, and then a sprint to the line after 20 minutes or 15 minutes of effort. There's very few riders that can hold on to Primoz Roglic's wheel. And it didn't really change much about what I thought for this year's GC, to be honest. Pogacar came second. Guillaume Martin came third. It was more Nairo Quintana coming fourth that was the big surprise for me in a sort of finale like that. It just showed that Quintana was already in pretty good shape and actually could be a real threat for the podium, whereas Bernal wasn't looking that good either. Did that change anything? Did that stage change any of your preconceived notions about GC, Benji, before the tour started? Because to me, it was just like Dauphiné round two.
Yeah, that's true. It did show a weakness in Carapaz and a slight bit in Buchmann, and basically confirmed that Martinez's GC was not looking too bright either from that point onwards. Those are the three things I really took out of that stage. The rest of the riders were as on point as I expected. Chavez was overperforming a bit, and yeah, in the coming stages after this one, he did show to not be up to standards with the other guys that he finished with on Ossia Merlet. But it certainly cemented Roglic in the position to take the yellow jersey if Yates loses it. So, yeah, that's basically how that happened.
Yeah, that was, you know, Roglic has just accumulated bonus seconds very efficiently throughout this first week, especially on this Ossia Merlet stage. One thing we haven't mentioned, and we've barely mentioned any Movistar riders in this year's tour, not our fault, by the way, they've largely been anonymous, is Alejandro Valverde losing 20 seconds in a finish like this. In 2018, Alejandro Valverde would probably be the odds-on favourite to get on the stage podium for a stage like this. And I think it's really showing that either lockdown meant he's didn't train like normal, or he hasn't had the racing he usually has, you know, all those Spanish tune-up races he usually does in January, February, March or whatever to get ready for the proper World Tour European season. He hasn't had them, or maybe it's the fact that he's like 40 years old. But yeah, have you been surprised by Valverde being pretty much anonymous in this week one, Benji?
Not necessarily, because the Dauphiné was pretty terrible as well. I do want to note that despite Mas not looking too great in the first few days, he has been a bit better in the latter days, I recall. But I'll have to check in GC in a second if he's still remotely up there after stage 9 and such.
Stage 5 was Gap to Priva, the first Wout van Aert stage that he won in this year's tour. Probably not the last, well, it definitely wasn't the last then, but I think he might win more than two as well. Adam Yates went into yellow on what I said was one of the most boring stages in Tour de France history, but definitely one of the most boring I've ever watched. Yates and Alaphilippe finished in the same time in the bunch, and then Alaphilippe got that penalty for holding on to, or for getting a bid on within 20 Ks to go. I did make a video about that saying, oh, you know, it's a little bit harsh and I don't think it was a conspiracy by Quickstep. But honestly, seeing everything that's happened since, seeing the way Alaphilippe, in my opinion, has deliberately lost, like when he did that faux attack and then lost 18 minutes on, I think, stage eight, I don't think Quickstep really cared at all. I mean, they were like, oh, it's a shame, you know, it could have been in yellow. But I think they knew they were going to be losing that jersey and it really was going to be Alaphilippe going for stage wins as much as possible in this year's tour. Benji, do you think when Yates took that yellow jersey that Mitchelton should have done what they've done and try and keep him in the jersey for, it was actually 4 days, and potentially miss out on a stage win in stage eight or nine? Or, yeah, did you think they do the right thing or not?
Honestly, do. It's a bit dishonorful if you have the yellow jersey and then decide to lose it on purpose. Like, losing time on purpose to go into the breakaway is a valid thing, but doing so in the yellow jersey is a bit harsh, in my honest opinion.
Okay, maybe that's me just, that's not even thinking outside the box. That's just, yeah, I agree, that's lunacy. I don't know why I even asked that. A better question then. Let's take two. Have you been surprised, given Yates took that at the end of stage five, and we had three, well, actually four consecutive pretty difficult stages after that? He did lose it after stage nine, but he held it for just about 4 days. Were you surprised at how Mitchelton and Scott were able to protect him and ride for him? Or did they even protect him and ride for him? Did Chavez and Nieve even help Adam Yates? Or is Adam Yates just really good at looking after himself in tricky scenarios?
I believe that he had a team around him the moments they were there. Nonetheless, they weren't really there in the most decisive moments. But then again, I don't believe that Chavez and Nieve are up to standards for domesticating on the final ascension, for example, on mountain stages. In the past, they might have been, but not in this Tour de France, at least. Nieve was the strongest of the two, even on the last two stages, if I recall correctly, but I could be wrong there. Nonetheless, I feel like they did that well. They didn't really spend their team on it, and they shouldn't, because I believe that Mezgech is also here to try and get some results. And if Mezgech, for example, had to cipher himself away basically for Yates, then I'm not really sure if that's a good idea. They have the team to help him out in the mid-range mountains and not necessarily the last climb then, but the earlier mountains and mountain stage. And they did that to the best of their capabilities, and they honestly protected the yellow jersey decently, according to what they were able to. Do you have a different opinion? Or
I think they did a pretty good job, but I also think Adam Yates at Ineos is going to be a genuine GC contender if they send him to the right tour, right grand tour, with the right profile. I think, yeah, he is getting dropped by Pogacar and Roglic and Bernal up these sort of, they go on really hot pace in stages eight and nine, but at a tour that those riders aren't at, with medium mountain stages where he might be able to take time, he's a pretty good descender, he'll have better teammates at Ineos, I think he'll be a genuine, not just a super domestique there, I think he could be actually, I mean, it's not that controversial opinion, a genuine GC contender. And also, Mitchelton Scott, even though they kind of fly under the radar when they come in, you look at their team and start of a lot of the Tours de France, and you're like, meh. Especially that this year before the tour, I was like, not that excited by that team. And they always seem to just, you know, they're either winning stages, multiple stages, or they're getting the yellow jersey for a few days. And 4 days in the yellow jersey, that has to be a success for Mitchelton Scott. Stage six was the next mountain stage up to Montaigual, and it was pretty much a neutralization of GC with Ineos riding defensively on the front. So nothing happened on GC at all, really. Yates was able to keep the yellow jersey. Lutsenko won the stage. Do you think that's the last we've seen of Lutsenko in a breakaway winning a stage, Benji? He missed it yesterday. Like, why do you think he was... He just seems really hot and cold to me, and inconsistent. Like, I expected him to really be fighting to get in the break yesterday. Maybe he was, but yeah, I just feel like he's a hot and cold rider. Or do you see something different with him?
I agree, he's hot and cold indeed, that he's inconsistent in when he is performing. But I also think that he potentially might have had to help Lopez more on this kind of stage, although that felt a bit weird. I didn't even see him in the Lopez train, really, when they were training up the Mont Blanc next to the Jumbo train, because I swear I saw a full Astana train at a certain point there that didn't do anything in the end. Nonetheless, in regards to Utsenko, there are going to be more stages that he goes in the break, I feel. Yesterday was a pretty good day for that. But then again, like, the way the breakaway formed yesterday was super extraordinary. Attacking for basically, I think, 57-ish kilometers straight until we had one guy that eventually got away. I think you need to be lucky to get away there, and very strong. And Hirschi certainly was that on yesterday's stage, but maybe Lutsenko just missed it. We don't know.
Stage 7 from Milau to Laval. We won the second stage, won by Wout van Aert. Adam Yates again retaining the yellow jersey. This was the crosswind stage with Bora Hansgrohe lighting it up. And just another stage that goes to show, well, it's just hopefully a preview or a foreshadowing of something even more disastrous that might happen tomorrow in stage 10, which is supposed to be, hopefully, I haven't checked the wind forecast, Benji. I assume people on Twitter will tell me the day before or the morning of whether there's going to be good crosswinds tomorrow or winds. But yeah, hopefully, it seems that everyone knows, like, we're not geniuses. All the DS should know that there's going to be crosswinds, but every time a GC contender will get on the wrong side of a split, maybe just because there's not enough space on the road. And I want to ask you this question, Benji. It's a good rest day recap question. If Pogacar does not lose that 90 seconds or a minute on that stage, do you think we would have seen the exact same racing the last 2 days? Do you think Pogacar would have been just as aggressive?
Yeah, I believe that he would have been just as aggressive. He's that type of rider. We've seen it in the Vuelta last year. Additionally, he only lost that time in that split because he had a puncture 5 kilometers before the split happened, and I think he just got up the moment that the peloton started splitting, so maybe he just got unlucky that day. And at the end of the day, he basically said to an interviewer who asked him the question, are your chances gone for GC because you lost a minute today? And he basically said, it's only a minute, we'll try and get it back. So that was awesome, and he sure as hell did not disappoint the days after. I believe that Roglic might have maybe responded a bit quicker on stage 8 if he was closer in GC, but the way Pogacar rode up the Peresur is not exactly a thing you can repeat too much if you are another favorite there, because that was a nuclear climbing record, in the words of my friend here. So
the thing is, Pogacar actually did repeat that power on stage 9. I was seeing he actually did the same sort of 10-minute power just nearly on stage 9. And stage 9 was a harder stage. Their normalized power for the entire stage was higher than stage 8, which was, you know, stage 8 was cruisy and then just smash fest up Col de Peresud. But just bear in mind, stage 7, Pogacar doesn't lose that time, he would currently be wearing the yellow jersey. Now, maybe he wouldn't have got that little bit of leash from Roglic on stage 8. Whether Roglic could have followed him, we'll never know. But what one thing is for certain, Roglic will be trying to follow Pogacar when he goes up the road, if he ever attacks again in this year's tour, because he's too close on GC, and we've seen what he can do, and we saw that on stage 9. But stage 8 was the second time that a breakaway actually won the stage. Nans Peeters, who I believe you, Benji, called for a stage win on the Tour de France preview, and Adam Yates still retained the yellow jersey for a fourth day. What did you think about Pogacar's Peresud climbing record in hindsight, Benji? I got a few thoughts on it, actually.
I do want to repeat again that I believe Jumbo made a mistake that day, and it isolated Roglic on the Peresud, and maybe if they didn't do so on the Port of Belez, breaking their own team, they might have been there to support him better. I'm not sure what you are referring to, but I'm very eager to hear it.
I don't think the Tadej Pogacar Peresud record is as out of this world stratospheric as we initially thought it was. I think the Vinokourov record was deep into a Tour de France and, you know, maybe second or third week. The stage was incredibly easy, stage 8, or before the Porte de Balais climb, I think. But it was, they'd gone really easy for a lot of it and then tried to smash, you know, over the first half of it and then smash the second two climbs. When you look at what a rider like Pogacar can do in training, 6.5, 6.6 watts per kilo for 20, 25 minutes, he's probably done that in training before. And What's surprising is, yeah, he had a hard day the day before, but they've had a lot of easy days, the GC men, the days before as well. Like, Montaguel was easy, easier than they expected. Gap de Pliva, easy, like one of the easiest stages ever. Nico Roche was joking that they got put on half rations because they couldn't eat too much food because they didn't burn enough calories that day. So I don't think the Pogacar-Pedersen record is like just completely mind-boggling. And I actually don't think we need to be... A lot of people were like, should we not be concerned about this because they're beating Ivan Meyer and Vinokourov? And I was like, not really, to be honest. Like, Vinokourov did that all on his own. Pogacar had a bit of a lead out as well from Jumbo-Visma for a lot of it. So obviously unbelievable performance, right? Like, still really impressive, etc. I'm just saying, I'm just trying to quell some of the cynicism that's coming through about performance. Yeah, do you feel the same way, or do you think I'm like belittling his performance?
I totally agree, and I'm going to compare it to something totally different. A lot of people have the same responses to Remco Evenepoel. You either have the people that, well, this is very controversial, so I'll just go over it and say my opinion. So you've got a lot of people that are extreme fanatics of Remco Evenepoel that hype him up every time he does anything. And then you've got the opposite people that don't like him, and they basically pull the doping card every time. And I believe that every attack that we've seen so far is relatively explainable. I'm going to take the Polonia solo from Evenepoel as an example. He rode away on a stage where basically at that moment he was in the front group with Ballerini, and he rode away, and at that moment, the first three-ish minutes of him riding away from that group, we saw in the second group that there was no cooperation at all. There was one guy pacing. I think it was Dunbar, actually. And the moment that he started pacing all out, they took time back on Evenepoel on a little hill. But the moment he was off the front, you had Ballerini riding first, a teammate of Evenepoel, slowing down the pace like crazy. And he rode there for like a minute straight, just at the front, upping the gap to like 50 seconds. And that makes it less unbelievable than people proclaim it to be. He's a cyclist like any other, but he's extremely awesome. And I, as a Belgian, I'm obviously a fan of him, but I'm also not going to be the fanatic that makes everything sound like he's 20 times better than everyone. He's an amazing cyclist. But on the other end, people don't need to pull the doping card every time somebody beats a record, in my honest opinion. And I'm always somewhat an avid fan of innocence still proven guilty, because a lot of people, every time somebody does something great, they start already bashing it and looking for a negative thing around it. And I want to enjoy it as much as possible in the moment itself.
I mean, we haven't really addressed this on the podcast yet. And I've really never explained my sort of overall perspective on doping, etc. But on a general, broader level, I'm very cynical just about sport. I'm just very cynical. But I'm not going to, and I've had this happen to me before where it stopped me enjoying cycling, where I couldn't enjoy performances because I was just getting too cynical about every performance. So I'm like you now. I don't criticize an individual unless it's like a Raul Alarcón Volta Portugal. That's like different OJ stuff. But, but, you know, I'm just going to enjoy an individual's performances and still have broad concerns generally about anti-doping in sport, not just cycling. And you gave that Remco Evenepoel point. I'll give you another one. The Froome Landis stage. If you go through and watch that, and remember, we all just watched stage 9. Who was the worst descender on stage 9? Sebastian Reichenbach. And who was the man who was sandbagging and, you know, anchoring that chase of Froome in the Giro d'Italia? Sebastian Reichenbach. When you actually look at what happened, and if you're calculating time gaps and when those time gaps occurred, like when the Hirschig time gaps occurred, but then when you go to the Froome stage and say, okay, was he dominating them on the climbs, or was it every time Reichenbach was on the front, he was slowing them down by like a minute on every descent? And we looked yesterday, every corner, the first corner of every descent, Reichenbach got popped off the back. So as you said with the Evenepoel example, there's often other explanations for why sort of these crazy performances can happen. But anyway, stage 9 was from Pau to Laurent. We just had that yesterday, won by Tadej Pogacar, the leader after the stage, taking the yellow jersey, the jersey he didn't want, the jersey that's going to, it's just weighing so heavy on their shoulders. You know, Jumbo-Visma saying they didn't want the yellow this early. Roglic going into yellow, a stage winner from Slovenia, and the yellow jersey going to the other two Slovenians, one taking the stage win, one taking the yellow jersey, 1-2 on the line, beating Mark Hirschi. What do you think is the ceiling for Mark Hirschi, Benji? And like, what's a comparable sort of rider for him that's his ceiling in terms of his potential?
It's hard to really name one necessarily, but I do want to say that last year we already saw a wonderful performance in him getting third on the San Sebastian that Remco won. So he's definitely not a rookie there. And this year, I feel like he grew a bit more towards being more climby in proper mountains instead of just the punch, because last year he did also pretty well at the Bing Bang Tour. And I think he got pretty close there even in GC as well for a second there, but I'm not sure about that. And I think he got second or so in Hufalize. Not sure about that, but I saw him more as a puncher last year, and he's growing more into a rider that can do both the punching and both the climbing on proper climbs. You saw that at the Dauphiné as well. And additionally to that, who can I compare that to? I kind of feel like he's slowly but surely growing towards Joaquim Rodriguez from the past, in the sense that he's got the climbing. He's not at that level, of course, but he's got the climbing and he's got a serious punch to it when it comes to, if it comes down to like a finish on top of a climb, for example. But yeah, we will see him grow quite a bit more in the future, I think.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what he turns into. He's so young, and yeah, it was a shame what happened yesterday, but I'm sure he's going to get plenty of big World Tour victories in the future. So the status of GC on the rest day, Primoz Roglic first, Egan Bernal second, 21 seconds behind Roglic, Guillaume Martin third, Vukovidis 28 seconds behind, Roman Bardet fourth, 30 seconds behind, Quintana fifth, 32 seconds behind, Rigoberto Urán with the same time. Tadej Pogačar still 44 seconds behind Primoz Roglic. Adam Yates bumped down to 8th on GC, and Miguel Angel Lopez 9th as well, and Mikel Landa rounding out the top 10, and Richie Porte 11th. And Porte had a pretty good stage yesterday, and he finished stage 9 safely. So a few things have happened in GC. Tom Dumoulin's clearly not going to be a GC contender for Jumbo-Visma in this year's tour. Egan Bernal losing time to Roglic in week 1, 21 seconds. Nothing to turn your nose up at, given that every second might count coming into that Planche de Belfia time trial. I think 44 seconds for Pogačar relative to Bernal, Martin, Bardet and Quintana and Urán is nothing, because he, on the Planche de Belfia time trial, I expect him to make up significantly more than that on them, but not on Primoz Roglic. But let's get into who we think after the first week is the best sprinter, the best climber, the best all-rounder and the strongest team in this year's tour. Benji, who do you think is the best sprinter? And I'm not going to say all-round sprinter or whatever, just who you think is the best sprinter in this year's tour?
I believe the best sprinter in regards to making his way through the peloton in a sprint and the actual speed he can meet and the watts he can pull is, in my opinion, Caleb Ewan. But I do want to add to that he doesn't seem to get into the right positions at some points, and that's a bit of a weakness there then, I guess. He obviously lost a significant portion of his train, but still, I expected a tiny bit more maybe regarding positioning. And obviously, I think he fell as well on the first stage, so we can get him some slack maybe, and hopefully we can see him towards the end of the third week maybe. But Wout van Aert, of course, we got to name him. He is not necessarily the strongest sprinter in this Grand Tour, in my honest opinion, compared to a Ewan, but he is there on the hardest stages where Ewan is not. And he's also better at positioning pre-sprint, I feel like, because he's always near the wheel of Bol, and that's a pretty good idea if the Bol train is so crazy like it was in the first week.
My pick, and maybe I'll get booted out of Australia for this, my pick is Wout van Aert, because sprinting is not just about top speed. That's why I said just best sprinter. I didn't say fastest man or whatever. Best sprinter, positioning is part of it. Wout van Aert doesn't have a train either. He ain't got nothing. And he still won two stages. Yeah, I think he's the best sprinter, because maybe he doesn't have that top end speed on a flat sprint. And, you know, we'll see it on Champs-Élysées how he can go. But positioning, timing, that's all important. So my pick is Wout van Aert. the best climber in the week, first week, and the best climber in this year's tour, I think, is Tadej Pogacar. But we haven't hit Colombier and Col de la Loz yet, but I think it's still Tadej Pogacar. I'm not sure Bernal and Quintana will be able to drop him, you know, on those big climbs, and certainly on the below altitude, not so long, you know, the 40 minute or 25 minute climbs rather than like the hour long climbs. I think he's the best climber given how aggressive he's had to be, and then still winning a stage after attacking three times yesterday, by the way, and then contesting the sprint at the top of the Mary Blanc and beating Bernal easily there. So I think Pogacar is the best climber in this year's tour. Who do you think?
I totally agree. And necessarily, I do want to add to that that I do believe that Bernal is really growing quite well into the race. And we had it last year as well. In last year's Tour de France, we started in week one, where he basically lost out on Planche de l'Alpe. And he also lost time the week after on Pas d'Albi stage, where Pinot got time. And the day before that, he lost 8 seconds or so on the Tourmalet. So I believe that Bernal is currently better than he was at this point in the race last year. If he slowly but surely keeps growing a tiny bit with that form, I know you don't like the word peaking, but it feels like he's somewhat moving up his form to the third week. I'm trying to avoid the word here. Come on. But I do believe that he's a factor to deal with on Col de la Loz and Colombier, but not necessarily in danger for Pogacar, really. I really think that Pogacar will keep up this form he's shown in the Vuelta last year, that he grows in the race and even becomes better and better into the third week. So let's hope that's the case here as well, because then we're going to see awesome stuff in the third week. But let's hope he's not too great either, that it doesn't become boring. Now, I do believe that Bernal's growing in the race a tiny bit, and that he's leading up towards being really strong on Colombier and Col de la Loz, because those are the climbs where I expected him pre-TDF, and it's more and more looking like we indeed are going to see him there. Nonetheless, Roglic, he hasn't shown severe weakness yet. He's always there when he needs to be there, and therefore I can't really say whether he's going to be able to follow a Pogacar and a Bernal on Col de la Loz and Colombier. I just can't judge it, really, because we haven't really seen him show any weakness, but we haven't really seen him show any strength either. So I'm kind of double-sided on him.
I don't know. I think he has shown strength when we look at the way he was leading out for almost a kilometer on the stage, end of the stage yesterday, and was actually coming back to Pogacar in the sprint and, you know, didn't have much of a draft. I actually think he was more focused on just getting that yellow jersey, keeping time on the group behind him, and stage win was secondary. I still think he's looked pretty strong, actually, when he's needed to. But, and also, winning GC is not just about who can go up the climbs the quickest. We saw that with Pogacar losing time. You know, would it surprise you if Pogacar lost time tomorrow in the crosswinds? It wouldn't surprise me. And I think Jumbo-Visma, I did have question marks about the way they can protect Roglic in crosswinds, because I don't think Roglic is perfect in them either. But he's got the Belgian Shepherd, Wout van Aert, to look after him. So we saw that on stage seven. He, like, I even saw a side, like, slow-mo pics, or I in the ITB video I made, it was a section of the video where I saw Wout van Aert literally pointing to where Roglic needed to go when Kwiatkowski was drilling it. He was, like, pointing where to move up, etc. So, yeah, I think Roglic should be okay in, like, crosswinds or mixed terrain, because he's just got that, you know, hair sink, Wout van Aert, etc. Whereas, yeah, Pogacar doesn't really have that that team support when it really matters in decisive moments. I don't think even Formolo yesterday, like, I thought he might have been able to stay in front of them and then be a launch pad for Pogacar. But anyway, who do you think, Benji, is the strongest team in this year's tour? I won't prattle on it. I think it's Jumbo-Visma.
Yeah, I don't think we disagree on that. And I don't think anyone really disagrees on that. We do certainly have sometimes our doubts whether the team is used in the most efficient way. We've explained that in the previous podcasts a bit, that we believe that they sometimes go a bit too early and it's costing Roglic a tiny bit. But then again, it hasn't really cost him too much because he's in the yellow jersey. So we can complain as long as we want about the tactics that Jumbo is using. But if he's in the yellow jersey and stays there, then they're doing a good job, I guess. Additionally, I do want to add regarding the team of UAE that we didn't talk about Aru yet. What's your opinion on
Haru
being out of the race and the way his team manager responded to that, which in Mana's opinion was not very professional of the team manager?
Yeah, so what's his name? Saroni is the team manager. I think it was Saroni Senior. Came out on, I don't know where he said it, but I saw his what he said quoted on Twitter, which is how I receive most of my information, second or third hand, so it's usually wrong. But he was saying, you know, Haru, he basically said, Haru is a disgrace. Haru is psychologically weak. Why do we even bring this guy to the tour? Haru has cost Tadej Pogacar by being selected and even being here. And you know what? I do not blame Fabio Haru for a second. I blame the leadership and the decision makers at UAE Emirates. I said, I think in the Vuelta a España, like I said at the end of 2019, and then I said when they selected their Tour de France team, I was like, you guys, actually, no, they don't. I was about to say, you guys should have Tadej Pogacar's power data, but his power meter barely works for the entirety of 2020 so far. But anyway, you guys should know that Tadej Pogacar is like going to be probably top three GC rider in the world for the next 5 to 7 years at least. Fabio Haru is not very good anymore and hasn't really done too much since 2015. I know he had the heart issue, and I'm not, you know, he's coming back from the heart stuff. That's not his fault, but the reality of it was they were saying, oh, it's sort of joint leadership, yada, yada, yada. I was like, it's obvious to everyone that's watching that you should be all in on Pogacar. And yeah, I think they kind of took Haru actually expecting him to be good, and that's why they're so disappointed. But yeah, I agree, Benji, pretty unprofessional comments. Do you have any criticisms for Haru? Like, what did you see that actually meant he was, what did he say, that he, any adversity, he turns into mush or something?
I genuinely can't really judge on it. I don't know the severity of his injuries of the past. I don't know how that was handled by the team surrounding him, how he was supported during those events. It's really hard to judge this from outside. And I feel like the fact that he doesn't have any team support on that, it is horrible. And the fact that his own team is saying that about him, like seconds after he gets out of the Tour de France in such a horrendous way, it's just mind-boggling. I don't get it. Saroni, what a douchebag, genuinely.
Yeah, the only counter to that would be if, like, Haru was actually saying and expecting people to carry bidons for him and,
yeah, that's
like,
true,
having domestiques come back for him in, like, previous stages, which, we, you know, that might have happened. Like, we saw at Astana, you know, he seemed to expect Landa and Co to ride for him. That was also the team deciding to do that as well. So yeah, it's hard to say without knowing it, but I think we both can both agree that he didn't need to be saying that stuff to the press, because it's been a good tour so far. Well, Pogacar looks good. I'm not sure it's been a good tour so far for the UAE management and DS, but they're still in a pretty good spot, and they've got who we think is the best climber in the race. So I think just, yeah, keep the tweets or the quotes to a minimum, Saroni, and focus on telling Tadej when crosswind sections are about to happen and looking after him. Because otherwise, he signed till 2020 forever. But I had people saying, imagine if he went to Astana and had, you know, support of Lasov or Fuglsang or whoever, or the Izaguirre brothers. It would be a whole different animal. But onto some hashtag LRCP questions on Twitter. We asked for your rest day questions. One from Konstantin. Question for the rest day podcast. Riders like Buchmann and Pino, who aimed for the GC podium, are clearly out or clearly not contesting GC. Why continue riding the Tour de France? Wouldn't it be better to step out, properly recover from their crashes or injuries, and then focus on this Giro Vuelta? You can have a first crack at this, Benji.
It's hard to say, because Buchmann didn't look horrible up till yesterday, in the sense that he hadn't lost like multiple minutes yet. And yesterday it was where he really just fell through and lost the rest of his time. And I believe that maybe today is a turning point, that either he has to go for stage wins or he decides to step out. But I do believe that it's very dependent on his injury. I'm not sure how far that is the cause of this. Most likely I would expect that it is the cause of his current behavior in the race. But I don't know, it's hard to judge really. I would not necessarily... I'm not really a fan of stepping out of the race instantly, because that basically removes any perseverance. But on the other end, if you're injured, you shouldn't be racing. So it's double-sided, and I don't know. So I'll give it to you.
So I think there's different levels to this. I think someone like Wout Poels shouldn't be riding. It's just, it's like not even safe, really. Like, he's properly injured and there's literally nothing to gain. He should be at home, you know, in bed, just about. Like, he shouldn't be. But Bookman is pain-free. So I don't see the harm in him trying. And until yesterday, hadn't lost too much time. And, like, Bookman is still riding it over 6 watts per kilo for 20 minutes. So, like, that's not injured. And, you know, maybe he... Jesus Christ, I'm going to say it. Maybe he peaks in the third week and gets better with the racing. And, yeah, maybe like Guillaume Martin and co. And he just gradually moves up and he gets like fifth on GC. Yeah, it's not what they were aiming for. It's not what the German... Because, like, I've had a lot of people and I've even been criticised, even though I'd say I'm for an English-speaking, am I media, but English-speaking cycling person, I think I'm pretty... I cover Bora and the German riders a lot. And people are like, why aren't you talking about Buchmann enough? And because in Germany, apparently people are like, he could really win the Tour. There's a strong likelihood he could win the Tour. But going into the Tour, no one really thought that, given his crashes, etc. So I think Buchmann's looked good this first week. Honestly, he's certainly not embarrassed himself. With Thibaut Pinot, it's what Benji said on the other pod. It's... You don't want to abandon when you're an FDJ and you abandoned badly last year. Maybe Pinot just wants to actually finish the Tour de France because he's physically capable of doing so. But I think Pinot, for me, he should abandon because Giro Vuelta, maybe even if Worlds might not be hard enough, but Giro Vuelta's beckoning. I think he should go to one of those races and redeem himself, either as a GC rider or going for stages, because I actually don't think he's capable of even winning a stage in this current form. Like, Hirschi just rode away from him yesterday easily. So that's why. Whereas Buchmann, he's capable of being competitive and, you know, top 10 GC in the Tour de France isn't something to be ashamed of. Pinot, I don't think so. Cut your losses. I agree with you, Konstantin, go the Giro. But it's a case-by-case basis. The next question from Wild Veriest, long-time supporter, #LRCP. Will Roglic regret not putting time on Bernal both on stage 8? And 6, and even maybe in stage 9. I feel like Bernal is peaking for Colombia and Mirabel. Is it possible Roglic has too much self-confidence? Well, yeah, he's obviously targeting Colombia and Mirabel, and maybe even, you know, he's definitely targeting them in Col de la Loz. But, yeah, I actually do think Roglic made a mistake on one of those stages, not trying to put time into Bernal and really working with Pogacar properly. Will it matter in the end? I'm not sure. Maybe him saving the legs, Roglic, means he'll have more pep at the end of the Tour de France to really dominate that time trial. So it's really hard to say. With all these things, peaking and whatever, if you're not looking at their power data and their heart rate and their recovery and all that and look at their proper physiological data, you're really just guessing and you don't know. You can look at their performances and say, well, he was actually flying in that stage because of his VAM and watts per kilo that you can calculate on a napkin, but yeah, I don't know. I can't really answer with any confidence. I think tactically it would have been a good idea to try and put some more time into Bernal if it didn't require too much extra energy rather than just waiting, but I don't think it's the end of the world either. What do you think, Benji?
Yeah, I've got the same opinion. I do believe that indeed that he made a small mistake necessarily to not use these stages more that fitted him better. But then again, maybe he's saving the energy to the stages where he expects to be under pressure more to try and make sure that he stays up there and doesn't lose any time on the Colombia and Col de la Loz and maybe even gains them accordingly. But I don't know. I still believe, as I said before, that Bernal's really targeting those two stages. It's probably going to fit him better than a Roglic does, but that's all speculation, of course. And yeah, it's a very speculative question that is pretty hard to answer, but yeah, I would say he might come to regret it, but he might not.
Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, the quick answer is we don't know. But that was the first part of our week one Tour de France wrap up. We hope you've been enjoying the podcast. The ratings on the Apple Podcast Store are just incredible. We're blown away by all the support, and we're going to keep these rolling. We've been really enjoying doing them. Yeah, I'm pretty tired, but hey, got to rest out today in another 2 weeks. And yeah, I'm looking at my TSS profiles and I'm probably ready to peak on the Colombier stage. But now Benji has to go and do some work, and we're going to bring in Leonard Kamner, the climber, the Critérium du Dauphiné stage winner from Bora Hansgrohe, the young German, a good guy all round. Here's our rest day interview with Leonard to check in with him. Welcome, Leonard Kemner, future Vuelta a España, GC podium, maybe even winning the Vuelta a España pretty soon, future Tour de France stage winner. So what's happened today? Anything different in like a COVID Tour de France on the rest day for you?
Yeah, we need to do the COVID test. That's actually one of the biggest difference. And also that we don't have any media in the hotel. Like we only do it per call and maybe via Skype or now via Zoom. So that's the biggest difference. You have actually a quite relaxed rest day, to be honest. There's absolutely no stress.
That's what I'm wondering is after the Tour de France finishes, maybe riders will say, I wish the Tour de France was always like this, like a little bit less crazy, like less fans. There's still fans, but is it nicer not having so many fans and just like so many prep media people all the time? Like you've done tours before. Like is it better that way?
Nah. For example, after the stage, you normally do like one interview in the mix zone and everybody has his microphone there and then you're done. And now you have to tell like three times in a row the same thing, and it's actually pretty annoying. And also with the fans, yeah, but normally it's like pretty crowded, and you can feel for 3 weeks a little bit like a rock star, and now it's everything a little bit more quiet, only on a few big mountains with a lot of historic background, you have a lot of spectators, and the rest is super calm. So actually there is something missing on the tour for sure. So I wish we have a normal one again.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Hopefully next year it'll all be fine. I mean, I'm glad that you guys are still able to ride the tour. Thanks for calling in at midnight Australia time, early day for me today. So how has the first week been? It's like you did the Vuelta, I think, in 2017. A lot of people said like 1,000 times, it looks like a Vuelta first week sort of profile. What was it like having a mountain stage on stage two? And yeah, has it been a different week because of the profiles, or has it still felt like a Tour de France profile?
I only did like one tour before last year, and there we had like everything in Brussels, the first three stages. That was like, it was hectic and more narrow road, so it also was super stressful. Now we had like this crazy first stage, which was like completely crap, and then we went to the second one, which was immediately, relatively hard from the profile, but we didn't run so hard the first two climbs and started re-racing like the last two climbs. So it was actually okay. When I remember 2017 in the Vuelta, I was suffering big time, especially in the first week. I was actually only in the wheels and I was thinking like, wow, how can I survive this Grand Tour? And this time I had a better shape and it felt much easier than the Vuelta actually.
Yeah, so I felt like, I mean, I got no idea exactly how hard the stages are. Like when you're looking on TV, you can't really tell how hard it is. But on that stage six, like Monte Boal, the first sort of mountaintop finish when Ineos went to the front, I was pretty sure I was like, that's not actually that hard a pace for guys like you and the GC guys. It seemed pretty easy. And then the stage that Pogacar set the Peresud climbing record, it seemed like the first half, again, like the breakaway went Mitchell and Scott not chasing and then like easy again. And then it seemed like everyone just smashed it up Peresud. Was stage six being maybe a little bit easier than people expected? Did that feed into you guys going absolutely crazy on stage seven when you did? I think I'm pretty sure I saw your power data. You did 8,000 watts for like at least 2 minutes. Was stage six being easier? Did that contribute to stage seven, what you did? Or were you going to do that anyway? Was that always the plan to get Peter in the break or split it?
Yeah, actually stage seven was planned a little bit different. We have like a hard race in the beginning and made this jumping, but after 1.5K jumping was already over and nobody wanted to go in the group. So yeah. We changed plan and Max Schaffmann was absolutely drilling it up to that climb. And in the end, Felix. And I was in the back with Emu. We were like on place 50-40 and it was it was like a proper all out to just stay on the wheel. And I was like, stop it, stop it. And from kilometer 18 on, I was like also in the echelon and pulling. And I was thinking, okay, if we go a little bit faster, I get dropped. And I don't know if I ever see the finish line again. So I was like, this is proper hard now. But in the end, it was okay. Like after the first 50, 60K, we had like a big enough gap. And then we could ride like with 300 watts.
And can you confirm that it was the climb at the start, that category 3 climb that split it? Or was it the crosswinds after? But I thought it was actually the climb that split it. And then like the little crosswind section afterwards just, I guess, made it easier for you to keep that gap. Or was there crosswinds like straight from neutral flag?
Yeah, it was on the climb. It was even on the climb, but it was crosswind because it was a really open climb. So everybody was hanging in the line and was even going uphill. So it was like absolutely bad to be in the back. You had absolutely no advantage of slipstream or something. So it was also mentally hard. You see some guys pulling in the front and you're hanging in the line. Heart rate, I don't know, almost on the peak. And then actually we had like where we expected we had headwind, and that was relatively bad for us because normally we could have made it even harder on the, there was one turning point where we went like down and then we had a hairpin to the left, and that was also where like everything went really hard, but we needed to pull. And if we have a little bit of tailwind there, everything would have exploded, I think, even more.
And that kind of goes into my next question. One of the people asked, because I said, oh, I'm interviewing Leonard, send through your questions. And one of their questions was, how do you deal with, as like you're there, I think you're primarily as a domestique, but maybe stage wins now, but we'll get to that later. How do you deal with sort of two priorities as a domestique rider, where one day you are pulling in sort of the echelon for Peter Sagan, and the next day you are riding like as domestique for EMU?
Yeah, maybe on that day it was difficult, on these 2 days. Normally, to be honest, we don't do so much for the green jersey as because we have almost like a climber squad. We are here mainly because of a good GC, or we were here because of a good GC. And you can also see it, like it was Schachmann, it was Großschartner, Mühlberger and me. We are not really specialists for crosswinds and leader train. It's not what we are here for. So it was in that moment a little bit weird, but it actually worked out pretty well because also with Austria, somebody who can give like a good, how you say it, command. He can set a good pace and they also say like, okay, now you can recover a little bit. I take some turns and that was pretty good. But I think if you do it for more than 2 days, like if it would be the next day again that we have to do full gas sprint lead out or chasing, then it would have been a big problem, I think. Now it was okay.
Yeah, and like I took a photo. I tried to take two photos, and I think you were on the front of the first echelon, and Tim de Klerk and Remy Cavagna were chasing, and you were gaining time on them. And I was like, Leonard needs to take this photo and put it on his wall because like he had the quick step classics train chasing, and you were gaining time on them because they must have been like completely blown apart from that climb.
Yeah, I guess so. Normally, Cavagna and Tim de Klerk are insane. When they pull in front, you're normally suffering in the back. So, we had a good spirit. We went smooth. And I think that was maybe our biggest advantage, that we were relatively constant in our turnings and everybody could recover a bit. And it's also a difference if you go with four guys doing turnings or if you are with two guys in the back trying to bridge across. And then you are more like going fully deep for like 2 or 3 minutes trying to get that gap down, and when you then don't make it, then you have like lactate, I don't know, 10, 11, and then you are missing more and more time because you cannot do a proper chasing anymore.
And I mentioned it sort of when I was asking one of the questions, I said you did 8,000 watts for 2 minutes. That's probably not known that well outside of Germany. Could you explain the 8,000 watts meme to people, or is it not possible to explain it?
I think it's hard to explain. It's like just a it's a guy who started like 2 years ago with random videos where he was saying 8,000 watts. He was asking like some shipperman, like, how much does this engine have, like, power? And then he's saying something and he just asked with answers with like 8,000 watts. So it's something completely weird, but it's somehow funny. We also say that only big chainring. And it's hard to explain. I just like the guy, and I think it's funny if you see 8,000 watts and only big chainring. It's just stupid talk.
Yeah, and like, that's why I like half the things I like about cycling are just random memes and just random funny things I see, or photos like the cycling out of context Twitter account where he just takes random like photos of people doing stupid things in the race is like half the reason why I watch cycling, to be honest. But
yeah.
You mentioned in one of your, when you were responding just then, that you were there for GC. You don't have to answer if like Bora doesn't have an official position on it yet, but are you going to get full license to go stage hunting now? I saw that from you yesterday when you were trying to get in the break. Will you be riding still for EMU or focusing on stage wins for yourself?
No, yesterday it was still for EMU. I wanted to be in the break to actually be able to help on the last climb to still be in front to maybe get back. But it was also like, if there is no problem, then I can also go for a stage victory or can try it. But this time it would have been super useful to have me in the front and try to chase the gap down a little bit more for EMU. But in the end, it absolutely didn't work out. And we got actually caught even before the last climb, which was the worst thing that could actually happen to me. But we cannot change it anymore. And I think we are all in for stage victories now, or we try to, because to be honest, with 4 minutes in the GC, you won't do a proper top 5 or top 10 result anymore. It's gone. Either you're going into a group and maybe sneak some minutes back, but normally you don't.
There's 10 guys in top 10 who are actually pretty close on time gaps. Like Yates is like 12th or 13th with only 1 minute. Whereas, you know, Uran, etc., they're all climbing. Like, yeah, Pogacar set that record on Peresud on stage 8, but also the other riders were not that far behind him either. So it seems like the level is pretty good.
I just wanted to say on Peresud, we had a lot of talent, actually. So even really? The Gopetto, we went quick with many watts.
I know, and I just said it on the podcast just before this. I was like, you know, because people saying, oh my God, Pogacar beat Vinokurov record on Peresud from 2003 or whatever. But I was like, the stage was pretty easy up to that point in the first half of the stage. Like his normalized power for stage 9 was higher than stage 8. Still, it's like, it's the Tour de France stage. It's not easy, but it wasn't full gas like from the start. He probably had tailwind on the climb, and Vinokurov did that in like second or third week. So all those things. And, you know, yeah, the tailwind takes it from, what, 6.8 down to 6.5. Still great, but...
Yeah, but I also think that the power data from Pogacar, I'm not really sure if they are correct, because they are so crazy insane. And we actually catch them today in the easy ride. And I was asking one of the guys from UAE, like, how's your power meter, or what kind of power meter is it? Is it only like measuring on left side, or is it measuring both sides? And he actually said it's only on the left side. It's even a carbon crank. So I think you can put some watts down. I cannot believe that he's doing like, I don't know, 430 watts over 20 minutes or something like this. It's just absolutely mind-blowing with his weight. And I guess it's a little bit less. If it's really that high, it's then I really have to train hardcore. Yeah. Otherwise, I'm fucked.
No, his power data and power meter, like, they've had issues all year. Like, obviously, you know, I got nothing better to do with my time. So every time there's a, like, climbing performance, I go look at their Strava, particularly mostly, like, Kuss and Pogacar. They've always put it up. And, like, his power meter or the head unit, there's been issues all year. Like, he has really bad dropouts. I don't know what product it is. But, yeah, what you're saying is like definitely in line with the issues they've had before. That being said, the VAM he did on Pettersson was still pretty high. So I don't know. We'll never know really his true watts, I guess. But yeah, you said there was tailwind, so maybe we do have to like knock that down a little bit.
But for sure, it was a super great performance. This is nothing I want to down now. So it was this insanely good, but maybe not as crazy as the what data is showing.
Yeah, and that got me to thinking. Do you think out of lockdown, given that we're seeing people on pretty good form, like people doing good, seem to be doing good numbers, does racing really matter in the lead up for pure GC riders? Like, or can they pretty much train on their own and get to the required level to compete in the Tour de France? Obviously, maybe a week of racing or a little bit of racing just for the handling and everything is useful. But like a lot of people were saying that, oh, the riders are going to come in like out of shape. Like the NBA players after the lockdown in the 90s came in like 15 kilos overweight. But to me, it looks like all the riders have been able to actually train for months uninterrupted, get a good program in, and they're at the same level. Is that your experience or what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that everything changed in the last 10 or 20 years. Maybe 10 or 15 years ago, also the cyclists would have been in bad shape without the racing because they didn't have like the same training focus like we have now. I think it's one of the biggest difference maybe between now and 2000. And in my opinion, we could also see it now after the Dauphiné or in the Dauphiné with Lombardi. Yeah, like all the guys who raced and crashed actually got interrupted in their build up. And this is actually what happens always when you start racing in February, March, April. You start crashing, you get sick. You have to go on reserve to some race where you don't want to be. And then always your preparation get disrupted, like you were saying it. And now everybody had time. Like some guys went like two or three times to attitude camp, could totally easily focus on losing weight, getting into proper shape. Because normally you also go to a race and then you're eating like full gas and you maybe gain a kilo again, which you normally in training you don't do. So you're maybe it's harder to actually really drop the weight when you're racing a lot compared to when you only train, because then you all have everything in mind. You can check everything yourself. So I think that the lockdown made it this hard because everybody is training like crazy.
Yeah, I think so too. Just looking at the level seems to be just as good, if not better, than in previous years. Maybe more crashes, but crashes, I guess, can happen any time. And often it's not been the rider's fault that crashes have happened. Like it was no one's fault that loads of crashes happened in stage, or none of the rider's fault that crashes happened in stage one. That was just shit weather and, you know, shit descents.
I never went on such slippery roads because it wasn't raining for months there. And then it was really like soap. You were just slipping around all day.
And how did that affect? I saw you still have your bandage on your leg. Do you just have like abrasions on your knee or something, like some rash on your knee? Or are you like recovered? It doesn't really matter.
In the first days, it really hold me back from performing on peak level. I was really far away from what I did like 2 weeks ago in Dauphiné. It seems like when you're crashing, you lose some of your last percentage. Like you could also see it in the heart rate. It's not going up that hard anymore like it did. And your body is like closing down. I don't know to explain it, but I couldn't produce like, I had like 360 over 20 minutes and I started to get dropped and I couldn't push more. And normally it's not a problem to do like around 390 or something. This is possible. And it's like missing out like 30, 40 watts on the threshold.
Yeah. And that's what I thought with, you know, with Bulkman, it's like, I think it's great that he's at the tour and hopefully he can like keep getting better into the third week. But that crash he had, there's a price to be paid for crashing, as you said. You know, even if he's still there, the energy it takes to recover, especially he had quite a bad crash too. the energy it takes is going to take something out of you. What do you think is going to happen in this second week? Do you think the intensity will increase a bit? A lot of guys have now lost a lot of time on GC, and I think we saw that yesterday, like three quarters of the peloton tried to get in the breakaway for 60 kilometers. How do you see the race panning out in the next week before the next rest day?
I think we could also see it last year. It was almost the same. Like when the GC riders were not in shape or had bad luck trying to get into the breaks, it's really get hard. And I think this will also happen next week. Always when we have like a mountaintop finish or a hard stage, everybody will go nuts to be in the break.
Who do you think is the strongest team right now? It looks to be, I mean, it seems like a pretty obvious answer, Jumbo-Visma. You tried to get in the break yesterday and they had people pulling hard the whole time. Are Jumbo-Visma the strongest all-around team?
Yeah, sure they are. I don't think that any team can match up with them. I think they did a pretty bad mistake with taking Tom Dumoulin out of the GC already. I think that was really not smart from them 2 days ago. And I also don't understand it. If I see him just pulling there and then getting a minute or something.
I don't agree. Because like, how can he be competitive on GC if he's getting dropped off Wout van Aert's wheel on the first HC climb of the tour on Porte de Ballet? Like, Wout van Aert was dropping him off the wheel, and it was just because they were at the end of the climb that he didn't get split from that group. He went from third wheel back to the end, and then luckily the crest came. Like, I mean, again, I'm biased. Before the tour, I was like, no chance. He's competitive on GC coming back from 400 days.
I don't know. I think he's not much weaker than he was when he won the Giro or when he went second in the tour. I think he's maybe almost on the same level. But for sure, the concurrence is maybe a bit higher. And also, I don't know if it's mentally or something, if he doesn't like it with the second leader. But I really, before the tour, I was really thinking that he can do, like, for sure, podium. Because he looked strong in the Dauphiné. There he did, like, a lot of work also for Roglic and was still there. Now he didn't look so good, to be honest, in the tour. But I was also thinking maybe the second week he feels better or the third. And for me, it was absolutely not necessary to lose the minutes with him. Like, also when he didn't look the best, it was still not they didn't chase somebody back. They didn't made Primoz Roglic gaining such a huge gap that it was really an advantage. So they didn't won anything with dropping out Dumoulin out of the GC. So they didn't gain something from it. It was just, they did it and it happened, but there was no outcome in my opinion.
100% agree with what you just said there. What I disagreed was I didn't really see Dumoulin as like a genuine contender compared to like Bernal, Pogacar and Roglic. But to your point about why was he pulling so hard on that climb and then Roglic didn't attack. The opposite ride is Ineos on Montaguel. Apparently Bernal not feeling that good. So they just went on the front 5.3 watts per kilo and no one really attacked, but they weren't putting their own riders under pressure. Whereas, to your point, Dumoulin goes on the front, drives it really hard, then leaves Roglic on his own with 4 kilometers left, and Bernal and Pogacar are like looking at him, and it didn't really make sense.
What was obvious is that Pogacar was pissed about this crosswind failure of losing 1:20 or something, and he wanted to get it back, so probably he would have attacked. I guess so, because he's also like an aggressive rider. He wants to win and attack. You could also see it in the crosswinds, which was actually super interesting. Like I was in the second group then, and it was Pogacar and UAE full gas riding, also Pogacar himself. And for example, I think Landa or Mollema or Richie Port, they were all just in the group not doing anything and just let them Domestique do the work. And I was also thinking, like, why are you not pulling? Like, it's not it's not killing you now for the rest of the Tour de France if you do some turns here and you maybe get some seconds back, and it's never easy to gain 1 minute 20 back in the GC. And if you can hold it maybe on 50 seconds or even close it down to 45 seconds, then it's, yeah, in my opinion, more easy than gaining it back on the climbs.
On the front of the group, Alaphilippe was pulling, Pino was pulling, Roglic even pulled some turns. So the first group, or the GC guys, were like, hold on, we've dropped Pogacar. And they were hitting it. Yeah, they also sent their domestiques there. But yeah, they were like, every second matters in a Tour de France like this. We've got a stage 20 individual time trial. If someone loses, you know, people are going to lose positions on GC by maybe small amounts. And tomorrow, speaking of crosswinds, everyone's been talking about all stage 10 is going to be crosswinds. I haven't looked at the wind forecast. That's what I got to do before I go to sleep. Just look at the wind forecast for 30 minutes and try and work things out. But when there's a crosswind stage like that, what is the DS saying to you before the stage? Are they just saying, pay attention or keep him there? Or is there something more sophisticated that they might say?
Yeah, sometimes you have some really important points in the race where you have to be in front, where it's like so obvious it's going to be a crosswind that they're saying out there, and there. You have to be 100% in front with as much guys as possible. But at the Tour de France, it's so hard to get with the whole team on a crosswind stage to the front. It's like almost impossible because you cannot stay on third or fourth wheel. It's like everybody is bumping into you. You have actually no chance of even holding the wheel of your guy in front of you. So you're basically just trying to be in the front all day and trying to do it somehow with the group or with your teammates. But in the end, it's just... yeah, a bit of luck and also a bit of who has the biggest engine to just take a side and go full gas.
That's why I think people are like, oh, Ineos not looking that good this year. And it's like, I think people are underestimating how hard it is to get the whole team with 40Ks to go in stage 7 and line it out and then drop the other riders with a team that they didn't even have Luke Rowe there. You don't just decide to do that and, oh, then you make it happen. It's like actually a really hard thing to do. And keeping, like, Bernal, I think, is actually underrated in crosswinds. Like Bernal and Quintana, I know it sounds like a joke, but since 2015...
No, they're always there.
Yeah.
Same with Pigita. He's always there because they're good in positioning. And then with some good teammates, you're always in the front. It's not about, not only about the data, it's also about where do you get into the crosswind. If you're on position 60, you can have as much power as you want, you won't make it back. But on position 20, it's actually pretty easy and not a big stress. And I think what Sky or Ineos did on that stage in the end was like masterclass to be there with three or four guys. I don't have it in eye perfectly, but it was really not easy to be there with your team all together, being the first into that corner.
I did a video on it. I was like, yeah, I called it Ineos crosswind perfection because it was, yeah, it was really impressive. Which stages, or maybe you don't want to give it away, but which stages do you think there might be a breakaway that you could be interested in for in the next week or even the next 2 weeks?
To be honest, I don't have it in mind. I checked all the stages, but I don't mark them like in red because before the tour, we had like the plan that I'm going to be the domestique for Emil Buchmann. So I didn't mark some stages where I really want to go for myself. But I think we are just looking now from day to day. And when there's a mountain stage, I actually will try to be in the break. And every chance we have now, I will actually try to be there.
Well, I'm sure the comments on the video will have lots of informed opinions on which breakaway you should go in. People always have an opinion on that.
Suits me. I will definitely look it up. Maybe they have some good plans and tactics for me.
They'll tell you exactly the what to do and the what
just do, you know, for 6.5 words.
Yeah, for 20, it's just like that. What do you see for yourself in the next like 3 to 4 years? Do you have ambitions to become GC leader for 1 week races or maybe some smaller stage races, or do you want to be a grand tour leader in the future?
It's really hard to tell. Like before this season, I was like, okay, I would like to try Tour de Suisse to go for a GC there because it's normally a race which suits me, long climbs, and not super hot. So I was like, this is maybe perfect for me also. Yeah, I think this year also showed me that I'm actually good on climbs, especially as hard as it gets. It's, yeah, good for me if I'm in the top shape. If I'm not in top shape, it's actually not good for me, but it's for everybody the same. And for next year, I want to, yeah, even step up from my actual level, train a bit better in winter and some other periods. So I still think I have some potential left, and maybe also a Grand Tour. At least in my career, I want, for sure want to try it one time to contest for a GC. I'm not talking about top three or top five, but at least to try it and see if I can make it into the top 10. Because this is already absolutely not easy. This is a big task. If you make it into the top 10 in the Grand Tour, you're really a good rider. And some guys are actually, yeah, often think, yeah, okay, if you contest for GC, you have at least go to top three or top five. But this is such an insane level, and it's so hard to do that. So if I can ever make it, I would be super proud of it.
Yeah, and just not even having the insane level for one day, to not make a big mistake for 21 days as well, yeah, and lose 5 minutes is the other skill as well. That, you know, the sky, absolutely, except when they're crashing, but otherwise, like, sky don't lose time in crosswind stages or Ineos. You know, it's things like that as well, which make it so hard to, yeah, contest a podium for GC. But now the important question, what is your top three power rankings for German rappers right now? And where does Jesus sit in those rankings? I know I have my own rankings, but yeah, I need yours first.
Oh, it's hard to tell, to be honest, because I'm mostly listening to SSEO. If I'm doing German rap, it's like my absolute favorite from them, that's for sure. And the second one would be Zido, and I think the third one is maybe not from Germany, it's Apache. I don't know if you know him, but that would be the third rapper.
Yeah, so for context, when Leonard won his Dauphiné stage win, I think you'd seen maybe my Ulrich montage, or no, maybe you'd seen the Bora, the Sibiu Tour montage. Yeah, which matched with Jesus. Awesome. And yeah, it like doesn't make sense, but that's why it's funny. And yeah, Leonard was like, no Jesus, SSEO for my montage, please. And yeah, if you win World Tour stage, you get to pick the music for your own montage. That's how it works. Like,
I have some good suggestions for the next victories if I get some.
Okay, yeah. If you win Tour de France stage win,
for sure,
you can pick the music for your montage. Anyway, thanks, Leonard, for joining us for this rest day recap from your hotel room. I'm in Canberra. Perfect. It's been pretty chill. I've enjoyed it. Maybe we'll have you back on if you win a stage, or you know, maybe later in the season if you do Vuelta. But otherwise, thanks for joining. Any last comments for the Lantern Rouge fans or Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast fans?
Nah, no comment. Just enjoy it, and SSEO is the best.
Thanks to Leonard Kemner for that excellent interview. I hope you liked it. Go and check him out on Instagram if you did. Welcome back, Benji, both from working and following up on Tirreno Adriatico and the trade news or transfer news while I was doing that interview. We multitask here on the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast. Benji, that Tirreno Adriatico stage finish, we're not going to do a full Tirreno preview, but everyone, you've got to watch the last kilometer overhead shot. How shook were you when Pascal Ackermann went past Gaviria? And do you want to give people a play-by-play maybe of the last 2.5-3 kilometers?
With about 2 kilometers to go, we saw that Evenepoel Fast was moving up for Magnus Cort Nielsen. After that, we saw quite a few teams mingle around at the front of the peloton, and that actually caused the crash. We had a pretty small crash in the sense that not many riders hit the deck. We saw that Medellier hit the deck, I think Dainese, Kevin Rivera, and so forth. And last but not least, Vincenzo Nibali falling as well. Who do you think is the perpetrator per se in this crash, or do you think that it wasn't necessarily caused by someone making a bad move?
So I haven't really seen the proper overhead shot of what happened with the crash, but what I did notice was, and I kind of endorse the strategy, is that the overhead shot showing Gaviria with 2.8k's to go, he's literally freewheeling because he's mid-pack. Now, there's obviously a massive downside to just being mid-pack, sitting in the wheels with 2.8 kilometers to go, in that you're going to be a big effort for you to get into good position. Except He had a pretty good train, and they brought him up really late on the right-hand side, but then moved sort of slowly, diagonally, his lead-out man, who then pointed to a gap. And it did seem to be a little space for Gaviria and the last lead-out man to slot into. So that plan seemed to work really well. And then it cut away to a different shot quickly, and then there was a massive pile-up in that sort of area. Now, I'm not saying UAE caused the crash at all, but I'm just saying those two events were contemporaneous, and it was a really aggressive, but not nasty, but a good move, but a forceful move nonetheless from UAE to just move up late and then move across almost into the middle of maybe the quick step riders. So Benji Gaviria, do you know when he actually initially kicked for the sprint, and do you have any explanation for why he went so early instead of getting onto the wheel of Magnus Cort?
I think he went with about 250 to 300 meters to go, which is quite early, quite insanely early, actually. And it all had a reason, to be honest. With about a kilometer to go, we had a late attack by Adrien Petit, and he basically forced Gaviria to use his last lead-out man, who was in first position while Gaviria was in fifth position. He had three sprinters ahead of him between his lead-out and himself. And at that point, we saw that the lead-out of Gaviria basically had to close the gap to Petit himself with about 800 meters to go. So he was not there anymore the moment the sprint had to happen. So in the end, we saw that when that lead-out man was gone and Petit was caught again, that tempo stopped a tiny bit. Not necessarily stopped, but it slowed down a bit. And at that point, a bit later, Gaviria started to launch because, yeah, there was pretty much no one willing to take control again, and he had to launch early.
I don't know. Maybe he just thought Magnus Cort wasn't up to it at all. Maybe he was only worried about Pascal Ackermann, and he saw that Ackermann was about 12 wheels behind him or not even in shot. Rüdiger Selig, when you look at the helicopter shot, is looking around and thinking, like, where is Ackermann? And this was, I just spoke to, you know, as you know, Kemner, and he hadn't seen it, but I described it to him as, this reminded me of the Caleb Ewan sprint in stage three. Quite similar, actually. Ackermann just moving up through the wheels. But this was more insane to me than the Ewan sprint. And I also want to commend Fernando Gaviria, actually. I want to commend him on not shutting the door. And I think Gaviria would have been within his rights and definitely wouldn't have been penalised, I don't think, or shouldn't have been, if he'd stayed flush with that right-hand barrier. Because he was kind of on that line, and I think he moved a bit left into the middle of the field. Not a big deviation at all. Gaviria sprinted fine. But I don't think he knew Ackermann was there on his right-hand side. And if he did, he would have probably held his line on that barrier. But Benji, like, that gap is one of the tightest gaps I've seen a sprinter go through recently. And given how big Pascal Ackermann is as well, like, what does that say about the mentality of these guys? And yeah, like, what was your opinion on Ackermann going through that gap? Is it something to be excited about? Or, like, yeah.
I do commend it a bit because I genuinely like to see it. But on the other end, it's also, we're also complaining about deviations and such. But this is also kind of dangerous, honestly. It's like such a small gap and they're basically risking their lives. But I guess that's the art of sprinting, that you have to be kind of insane to be a top sprinter. And Ackermann surely was that today, because I know for sure that 80% of the sprinters would not take that gap. But it's also been a while since he's won a high-scale race. I think his last victory was a Sibiu Tour, so maybe just wanted it a bit more than other sprinters because he needed it mentally. And yeah, it's insane to take those gaps, and I wouldn't do it, but then again, I'm not a top sprinter, and maybe that's why.
Yeah, and I think there's been a lot of... There's been some people who... They got roasted when they were saying, like, there was the initial take when Jakobsen, there was that terrible crash, and there were like some hot takes from people which were just so out there, where they were like, well, this is just part of sprinting, you know, this is the risks these guys accept, and no one's really to blame because this is just what happens with sprinting, and they're all nutcases. And that wasn't correct in the Jakobsen example, because, you know, Groenewegen shut the door, etc. That's against the rules. We don't need to rehash that. But it also is kind of correct that sprinters are nuts. Like Jakobsen, the gap there when you freeze frame it, there was a moment where some people would have backed off. Same with Ackermann today. There's a moment there where I'm like, holy shit. When he committed to going through that gap, it was even smaller than the gap he did go through. But hey, it was an exciting finish. Congrats to Ackermann for sort of breaking a bit of a drought that you alluded to, Benji. Tirreno Adriatico kicked off. We knew it was going to be a sprint, so I pretty much just watched the last 10 kilometers. I'm not going to pretend like I watched the whole 150 or whatever.
Nonetheless, we had a crash also of Vincenzo Nibali, who hit the deck just riding into Medellier, pretty much, who was sitting on the ground at about 5K an hour. He rode into him and literally just fell over him in slow motion, but it looked like he was okay. Let's hope he's okay. Let's hope he can fight in the mountains in the upcoming stages, because I think there's one queen stage on stage five, and I'm genuinely looking forward to seeing Lo Squalo there.
Yeah, and he just, well, the Giro d'Italia just released that promotional video today, which they probably spent €1 million on, with Vincenzo Nibali as the star in it. So, yeah, shame to see him go down. I hope he's okay. A real shame for Kevin Rivera, because he spent so long trying to get back to Europe to race, and it was really difficult for him compared to other riders, and he finally made it there. You know, with the pleas of the help of a lot of other riders, actually a lot of other South American riders were put pressure on that to actually happen. So a shame that he's gone down and missed out. Tim Merlier was actually being led out by Mathieu van der Poel, and Merlier, we saw him, he won a sprint before. He's actually flying in the sprints at the moment. So it does sound surprising, Mathieu van der Poel leading out another rider, but maybe Mollier is just quicker than him at the moment. But that's enough on Tirreno Adriatico Stage 1. We'll be doing a Stage 2 recap tomorrow, obviously, plus the Tour de France Stage 10 recap, a double for you. But Benji, you're the master of transfer news and some of the lesser-known riders. What's the latest transfer news that's hit the press?
Basically, the first name that is transferring is one of the young riders from the U23 Giro d'Italia. His name is Filippo Concia, and he was fifth there at the Giro U23, and that's basically 7 minutes behind the oh-so-dominant Thomas Pidcock. Like, you watched that race more than I did. How dominant was Pidcock there?
Extremely impressive, you know. You see who's won the Baby Giro in the past. I think Vlasov won recently as well. Just dominated the race, really. And what really impressed me about Pidcock, and I'm going to do a video on it as well, sorry, I've been saying that for a while, is he actually rides pretty smart. He doesn't just go on the front and say, hey, my watts per kilo are just so obscenely higher than all the other juniors or under 23s. He was like actually forcing guys through, going to the back of the group. And you love to see that sort of stuff, even though he probably would have won anyway, but he was making sure of it. And yeah, I can't wait to see him in World Tour. He's obviously got excellent 20 minute watts per kilo, but that cyclocross background as well. He has awesome punch, you'd expect. You know, Giro d'Italia, sort of with a time trial. The sort of race that I expect him to do well at in a Grand Tour would actually be this sort of Giro route, because he can time trial really well. Look at his European Championships time trial and the time he did, and I don't think he's been training that much on a time trial bike either. And he also has really good punch. So Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Flèche-Wallonne, yeah, the sky's the limit for that guy. It pains me to say it. Obviously, I, you know, 10 years of Great Britain dominating World Tour, or Grand Tours, not World Tour, dominating the Tour de France, rather. And, you know, as a proud Australian, it does pay me to say it, but he looks like he's going to be a superstar for at least the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, and in regards to that, we had the fifth rider there, Filippo Concia. That's the person we were initially talking about. He's still signing for Lotto Soudal, so that's some young talent for the team. Additionally, four more transfers, I think. We have Tarame, after quite a few years of basically being not that special, just riding anonymously in the peloton, he's going to Circus Wanty-Gobert. He won quite a few Grand Tour stages in the past. The last one I remember was in the Giro of 2016, I think, stage 20, just ahead of Vincenzo Nibali, who had just dropped Chavez on the final climb. Yeah, it's potentially a good signing. I'm not sure what to think of it. It might still have potential, but he's 33, hasn't really done too much in the last couple of years, but he's a barrider and he likes to show some action in the breakaway. So let's hope he can do that at Circus. One of the next transfers is at Bora Hansgrohe, two on a day. We've got an unexpected one to me. That's that Wilco Kelderman from Sunweb is going to Bora Hansgrohe after, well, he's been quite unlucky in Grand Tours, hasn't he? Plenty of injuries and such. And now he's going to Bora. So maybe that's to help out the Grand Tour team. He's not the only one that's going to sign for Bora. We have Ben Zwiehoff, which is not actually known to me. He's a mountain biker. And yeah, that's a bit of an odd signing for me, but I'm down to see what happens.
Yeah, and I did actually have one World Tour rider, not from Bora Hansgrohe, and this was before that signing was announced, saying that a lot of the teams are signing like 100% almost on Power Data now. They're not even like looking at, oh, okay, how can they ride in a crosswind or something? So yeah, it's interesting to see these younger riders signed who maybe don't have the road results as well. Maybe it's people seeing, okay, well, Pidcock's really good at cyclocross. There's all these cyclocross riders that are really good. There's so many mountain bike. We have a history in cycling of mountain bike riders transferring across. Fuglsang, Rasmussen, Cadel Evans, the list goes on. If the Power Data's there and if they can handle a mountain bike, then they can learn how to race on the road, even if they haven't been, you know, racing on the road constantly. I'm sure this guy probably, you know, does plenty of road races as well locally that don't show up on pro cycling stats or whatever. But yeah, it's just interesting to see teams signing a lot of these riders. The next one, Benji, Matteo Trentin to UAE. What do you think of that? I'm kind of surprised by that, actually.
I actually don't mind. I knew it that it was very much rumored to be. It's basically just confirming once more that every CCC rider is riding for contracts right now and hoping that they can basically find a team for next year, because while CCC hasn't officially folded, it's more and more looking like it as every single rider is basically leaving.
I disagree with you. I do mind it because Trentin has a salary and he's not some mediocre rider. I presume he has a pretty, I mean, I don't know, maybe he has a heavy incentive and low base, but I'd assume he has a decent salary. And I just want to see UAE stacking their team with riders to support Pogacar's GC ambitions. Now, maybe Trentin can actually do a pretty good job of that and be useful, like on a crosswind stage or something, or I don't know, or just to be a road captain. I haven't really seen that from him yet, and I don't remember him doing that too much at Mitchelton Scott either. So, yeah, I think it's a shame that they're not focusing entirely on supporting Tadej Pogacar. Now, maybe those things aren't mutually exclusive. Maybe there's no salary cap in cycling, and maybe they've got a list of people they want to sign to do that. But yeah, that's the only reason why I'm against it, because I like Trentin as a rider. I think he's really strong, and I think he's looked pretty good in this year's Tour de France. Kelderman, I think, is not that good, and that's all I'll say on that. But is there any other transfer news, Benji?
There's not a rumor that Bora is signing a rider that does not have road race history or experience yet, and that's Jason Osborne, a pretty known rower. And basically, it's rumored that he has Power Data that is nearing Grand Tour favorites, which is a big call out to have. I have not checked that fact, so this could be total bullshit, but that's what I heard, and if that's true, then that's pretty cool to follow.
Yeah, so on my big to-do list is to get in touch with Jason Osborne. I followed him. I think we followed each other on Instagram the other day because people have been telling me to get in touch with him, and these are people in Germany and Central Europe, and they're saying this guy is actually legit. It's all legit. The rumors, not the transfer rumor, but the power stuff is legit. And, you know, look at what he did in German national championships, individual time trial, and I don't think he has the most optimized position either. So, yeah, it's on my to-do list to get in touch with him, and we'll try and get him on the podcast as well, maybe after the Tour de France, because, yeah, I want to hear what it's like transitioning from being a lightweight rower to apparently doing Tour de France Grand Tour contender or Tour de France GC contender power numbers. You can go and see him on Strava. I think he's got a lot of followers on Strava. And, yeah, I think his numbers are legit, and it just remains to be seen whether he can transfer them back to transfer them to actually road racing, because, you know, Leonard Kemner said to me today, it's not just about the numbers. If you are in bad position all the time, if you're 60th wheel in the back of an echelon in crosswind, then you're probably going to get dropped even if you're Fabian Cancellara, or maybe not Fabian Cancellara, but you know what I mean.
So yeah, that's basically it for today, guys. We had our Tour de France recap. We've got a 10th stage tomorrow. Let's finish off with that because we basically haven't done that yet. It is the flat stage from Île-d'Oléron to Île-de-Ré. It is the one with the echelons potentially. So I'm looking forward to it. Hoping to see echelons. What do you think?
Of course I'm hoping to see echelons. what do you think this is? Of course I am.
Great.
If there isn't, I'll be so disappointed. And I think that's how we'll end it. Thanks for listening, everybody. Make sure to rate us on your relevant podcast player or Apple Podcasts. Thanks for Benji for doing all the groundwork with the transfers. That stuff's really, really good insight. I'm sure you'll all appreciate that. So hit it. Let him know on Twitter with hashtag LRCP what you think of those transfers as well. Any last thoughts from you, Benji?
Ciao.